homage to all the glorious Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Om, homage to the glorious, blessed, noble perfection of wisdom. Likewise to victory over the states of existence taught by divine and human tradition. Swaha. Thus have I heard. At one time the Tathagata dwelt on the vulture's peak, in the profound sphere of reality, the profound Buddha region, with many great goddesses, including Sarasvati, and numerous gods, Nagas, Yakshas, Rakshasas, Gandharvas, Asuras, Garudas, Kingaras, Maharagas, men and non-men. Then the Venerable Ananda spoke to the Lord. Lord, what will be for them the training in the Dharma? Ananda, I will teach the excellent Suvarnabhasa, king of sutras, very profound on hearing and profound on examination. It has been blessed by the Buddhas of the four directions, by Akshobhya Raja in the east, in the south by Ratnaketu, in the west by Amitabha, in the north by Dundubhisvara. I will proclaim this blessing, the excellent auspicious confession, whose aim is the ruin of all evils, producing the destruction of all evils, conferring every blessing, ruining every misfortune, the basis of all knowledge, thoroughly adorned with every splendour. So that's how the Sutra of Golden Light, that's how the Sutra of Golden Light, the Suvarna Prabhasa Sutra, or the Suvarna Bhasotama Sutra, begins. And as I said last night, it's a very strange sutra. It's actually one of the first I ever read, one of the first Mahayana sutras I read, because it was available in this old Pali Text Society edition, even though it's a Sanskrit Mahayana sutra, and it was short, and it was quite cheap at the time. So that made it very, very handy. It was around. I read it and even would recite passages of it. I think I might have recited the whole thing for some reason, because I was very keen on that sort of thing, especially if things were rather sort of mind-rotting, if they were a bit exotic. So I did all that sort of thing before Bhante had made a decision to give a series of lectures on it, before I was ordained. And also I should say that after I was ordained, before I was ordained, the earliest FWBO, as it then was, puja book, included a short section from the confession chapter from the Sutra of Golden Light. And in fact, when I was ordained, in our first order meetings, as we called them, we'd recite this section from the confession, from the Sutra of Golden Light, because it referred to the 10 precepts. So let me just read it to you, because it does put me in mind of my very early involvement. May the Buddhas watch over me with minds attentive. May they forgive my faults with minds given over to compassion. On account of the evil done by me previously, even in hundreds of eons, I have a troubled mind, oppressed with wretchedness, trouble and fear. With an unhappy mind, I continually fear evil acts. Wherever I go, there is no enjoyment for me anywhere. All the Buddhas are compassionate. They remove the fears of all beings. May they forgive my faults, and may they deliver me from fear. May the Tathagatas take away from me the defilement of impurities and acts, and may the Buddhas bathe me in the surging waters of compassion. I confess all the evil previously done by me, and I confess all my present evil. For the future I undertake to refrain from all acts evilly done. I do not conceal whatever evil I may have done, the threefold bodily act and the fourfold with the voice, as well as the act in three ways with the mind. All this I confess. What I have done with my body, what I have done with my voice, and what I have thought with my mind, the tenfold act I have done, I confess it all. May I avoid the ten evil acts. May I practice the ten good acts. May I remain in the tenth stage. May I become an excellent Buddha. Whatever evil act I have done, bringing an undesired fruit, I will confess it all in the presence of the Buddhas. So that's what we used to recite in order meetings after we, I think either before or after we took our 10 precepts. It sort of died away, that particular practice of doing that. But maybe we should revive it, chapter at Padmaloka. Just a thought. So Bhante had made us aware of this sutra before his lecture series, which was in 77, 78, not long after I was ordained. And it was sort of around. And as well as verses like that, one of the other things I found incredibly attractive about this sutra was these wonderful praises in it of the Buddha. Really, really beautiful verses of praise of the Buddha. Some of the very best in Mahayana literature, any Buddhist literature. In fact, Bhante points to these verses in his lecture series. Really, really lovely. You know, if you really want to practice recollection of the Buddha practice, then chant these verses and meditate on the Buddha. It will really help you. It comes, obviously, through an Indian aesthetic, but nonetheless, it's extremely lovely, some of these verses. Especially the emphasis on how gold the Buddha is. I'll probably read some of these as we go on. So when we heard that Bhante was giving an 8-part lecture series, no, that public lecture series, I should add, at Hampstead Town Hall on Haverstock Hill, a public lecture series on the Sutra of Golden Light, we had to put posters up all over London, to get people coming, and they were very, very well attended lectures. When we heard he was going to do this, we wondered, well, what could he possibly do? How could he get 8 lectures out of this really short sutra, which doesn't even seem to be saying anything? And Bhante does address that, but what does the sutra actually teach? You know, throughout there's constant praising of this king of sutras with his extraordinary blessing and the incredible effects it's going to have on all these different sort of figures and all the rest of it. But what's the content? What's the message? What's the teaching of the sutra? All sorts of things happen in this sutra, as you know, often happens in Mahayana sutras. There are visions of Buddhas, there's an expanding house, expanding to infinity, which then becomes made up of emeralds. There's a big dream, there's a talking drum, there's all sorts of gods and goddesses coming forward who say they're going to protect the sutra. There are Jataka stories, birth stories of the Buddha. There are praises of the Buddha. There are descriptions of magic rites, to do with invoking particular goddesses and so on. But where's the sutra? You know, where's the teaching? You know, there isn't. You know, where's the? Doesn't seem to be any eightfold path type teaching in it at all, really. As Bhante says, it's a sort of transcendental rag bag, but a rag bag made up of jewels and colourful brocade and treasures. So what is this, the message of the sutra? Why are we giving it attention? And then Bhante says, as you read it, it dawns on you that the sutra is what is happening in the sutra. That's the sutra. It's what's happening within it. And every single detail within it is communicating something. It's pointing to something. The sutra describes itself as a profound Buddha region. And it opens with the Buddha not just dwelling on the vulture's peak, but dwelling in a profound Buddha region. Get this phrase coming up again and again, a Buddha region, a Buddha sphere. The word is translated as gochara, which means literally a pasture. So not just a sort of field, not just a sphere, but a place in which the Buddhas are nourished and where they get their nourishment from. Buddha region, you know, is probably related to the word Buddha field, Buddha country, Buddha world. So we're going to be looking at going into this region, hopefully, or getting a glimpse of it from afar. It's a region that Bhante opened up for us all those years ago in those lectures, and a region that's still available to us. You could also think of the sutra as manifesting, communicating a particular kind of energy, a spiritual, a transcendental kind of Dharma energy. It kind of manifests a particular force, a particular blessing power. It's very interesting, this, you know, the way we think about texts. You have to remember that for traditional peoples, texts have a magic power. And especially you find this in the Mahayana. I mean, you find it in the Theravada, we'll come to that. But perhaps especially in the Mahayana, the sutras are not just books. The sutras are much, much more than that. They're communicating something much, much more than that. They have a force, a power, an energy, a transforming power. We've also got the there's a puja that's been derived from this sutra. So you can see that the sutras sort of run into that, and we perform this puja regularly. We're going to be doing it throughout the weekend, so we're going to be in touch with the sutra in that way. But more than that, just not just in terms of liturgy, not just in terms of sort of magic in that way. This sutra, I would say, has had a very, very big effect on the course of the Triratna. Might seem very strange to you, but I know that the Lokamitra was profoundly inspired by this lecture series, The Transformation of Life and World. It had a really, really big effect on the whole course of his Dharma life. And not long after this lecture series, he was in India on pilgrimage and practicing yoga with Mr. Iyengar and Bhante, in a very relaxed way. Well, you might look up some of my old disciples in Pune and Nagpur when you're there and see how they're getting on. And of course, they asked him to teach the Dharma. They asked him to come and start a centre. And that was the beginning of our Dharma work in India, which has had a huge, you know, impact on the Triratna throughout the world. But Lokamitra is quite clear that a big part of his inspiration came from Sangharakshita's lectures on the Sutra of Golden Light, because of its depiction of not just transformation of self, but transformation of every single sphere of life. And Bhante speaks of the Sutra as an energy, as having an energy, and the nucleus of the energy of the Sutra is the long chapter on confession, which is really the heart of the sutra, which has kind of attracted to it all sorts of other material, which is particularly concerned with the transformation of the world. And in his, if you want to read Bhante's brilliant summary of the sutra and how the sutra came to be created, I'd recommend you read his introductory, his first talk. I think it's called The Development of a Mahayana Sutra. So in the sutra, basically you've got this confession, transformation of self, and then one by one, different gods and goddesses come forward and offer to protect the sutra, all adding up to what Bhante called the transformation of life and world. So yes, the confession is especially concerned with the transformation of life, of self, and the chapters of the different gods and goddesses coming forward to honour and protect the sutra represent the different forces in the world being transformed by the Dharma, by the golden light. So you have the four great kings, the four protectors of the Dharma, the Lokapalas, coming forward to protect the sutra. You have the goddess Sarasvati coming forward to protect the sutra. She represents culture. You have the goddess Drudha, the earth goddess, coming forward to protect the sutra. She represents nature. You have the goddess Shri, coming forward to protect the sutra. She's the goddess of money, of wealth, of economics. And then you have a whole teaching on the divine kings, and really that's to do with the whole social order, the transformation of the social order. So it's quite a sutra. And Bhante really opened up, I think, various themes for us to seriously follow up, both not just in theory but in practice. The basic message is every single aspect of ourselves, of our life, and our world needs to be transformed. If we're to live an effective Dharma life, every single aspect of ourselves and world, in the end, needs to be transformed. Life and world. You can see why this was a big inspiration for Lokamitra, why it was a big inspiration for us, all of us back in those days, because we weren't just, you know, meditating and practicing in that way. A lot of us were working, you know, very hard for the Dharma, particularly on turning the old fire station into the London Buddhist Centre. So this lecture series gave us a lot of support for our Dharma work in that way. And we want that energy to continue. We want that energy to go on, to never stop. The order, the real order, the true order is dedicated to that, to transformation of life and world in the light of the Dharma. What we're doing as within our order is not just giving the Dharma for people so it can make themselves more comfortable in the world, more able to just simply handle the stresses and strains of the world. That's not what we're interested in. We're not interested in making ourselves more comfortable. It is really important to understand, as Buddhism and practices derived from Buddhism just seem to be to do with just making people more comfortable, better at being consumers, and so on. I put it drastically. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in getting to the roots of the issue, transforming the roots of this, our life, and this world. That's what we're concerned with. Questioning all the assumptions that we live our lives on and which everybody is living their lives on. And Bhante says, what transforms is the golden light. The golden light, hence the Sutra of Golden Light, the Suvarna Basa, the golden light. Suvarna meaning golden, Basa meaning light. This is what he says about that golden light in that first lecture. This golden light that transforms both self and world is a spiritual light, a transcendental light, in the traditional Buddhist sense of Lokuttara, that which is beyond the world, beyond the conditioned. It is a light without beginning and a light without ending. It's a light which does not shine forth from anything, from anywhere, from any direction, although it might appear to do that. It is the light of truth, the light of reality, the light of the Buddha. And it's this light that we need to open up to. This is such a different way of looking at the Dharma life. Opening up to the golden light, being transformed by the golden light. And I can already hear, be through my divine hearing, no, it's a joke. I can hear the questions, even the conceptualizations. Well, what is the golden light? You know, the rest of it. I'm not going to... Bhante doesn't explain it in his lecture. So I'm certainly not going to try and explain it. You have to feel it, I suppose. Imagine it. If you don't, well, maybe you need to look at how literal you might be about the Dharma life. I remember... we asked Bhante back in the day, how do you tell whether or not somebody's ready for ordination? And he said, oh, well, what you're really doing is looking for a reflection of the transcendental. We all went, wow, not knowing really what he meant. But you can see what he was getting at. It's that, well, is there something of the golden light in someone training for ordination? Is there something of the golden light in an order member? Is it sufficiently alive in an order member? That pure, incorruptible, rich and golden light. Is there a particle of that light? Apparently this is something you get in Manichaeism, the particle of light, the particle of the man of light in every human being. It's not the same as the transcendental light of the Dharma, but I really like that idea of a particle of light. We need to work, become aware of that particle of light within us and work it into our consciousness, make it grow within us, and so it can transform us and live from that light, channel that light, even to use that sort of language, so it can transform every aspect, not just of ourselves but of our world. So let's start looking at what that transformation might turn out to be through looking into the sutra and looking into Bhante's lectures on the sutra. I'm not going to make any apologies for making quite extensive quotes from the sutra and from Bhante. So I'm going to go now to the second chapter of the Sutra of Golden Light. This is how it begins. At that time, at that period, in the great city of Rajagriha, there dwelled the Bodhisattva called Ruchiraketu, a great being who had rendered service to a previous Buddha, who had planted merit roots and was revered by many hundreds of thousands of millions of Buddhas. Ruchiraketu's name means beautiful streamer, beautiful comet, and he's clearly a great bodhisattva. In other words, he is a man fully and completely committed to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. He's prepared to do whatever it takes to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. In other words, he's playing no limits on his commitment. He's placing no limits on his spiritual development. You know, if you're serious about transformation, that's fundamental. That has to be a given. There's no limit that you place on your commitment, on your going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. When you become ordained, or indeed when you ask for ordination, but perhaps especially when you're ordained, you really are stepping into the unknown. You sometimes get this phenomena, people sometimes thinking or even saying, well, I didn't sign up for this. No, no, you didn't sign up for this. You signed a blank check. When you entered the order, you really did sign a blank check, and you have to really be prepared for anything, because, well, there's no transformation unless you're prepared to step out, right out into the unknown. You particularly feel it when you step out moving towards your private ordination, going alone, usually at night, into that private place where you'll find your private preceptor. You can really feel that. You don't really know what you're walking into, where the path is taking you. So it's very important to feel this. I also noticed too that that particular part of the description of Ruchiraketu. He had rendered service to a previous Buddha. Rendered service, probably the word is sevaka. He'd been the sevaka of a previous Buddha. Again, this is a very strong feature of Dharma life in, you know, traditional Buddhism, but it's a life of service. You're going into a life of service, of giving yourself up to your teacher, to your spiritual friends, and to the course of the Dharma. Your individual Dharma practice, your efforts, your meditation, your study is service. It's a service of the Dharma, and you're supporting of the work of spreading the Dharma is service. And traditionally this sense of being a servant of the Dharma is indispensable to Dharma life. Traditionally, if you were serious about Dharma life, you'd go and stay with your teacher and with the community around your teacher. And you'd serve. You'd get on with the work of serving your teacher. And that was part and parcel of your practice, as much as meditation and listening to the Dharma teaching. And it would be service in very ordinary ways. Sweeping, cleaning, cooking, clearing up, all that kind of thing. And we need to find ways, us moderns, to replicate that in the very different conditions of the modern world. I think this is so important because I think the modern world does encourage a kind of individualism, even, to put it rather drastically, a kind of narcissism. And our Dharma life, so-called Dharma life, can very easily become an exercise in a kind of narcissism where we get overly concerned with our feelings, overly concerned, get very, very precious about our comforts and our state of mind, but not in a deeply ethical, dharmic sense, but how we feel, all that kind of thing. And Dharma life becomes more about adjusting things to suit our comfort rather than opening up to something greater, which is what Dharma life is really all about. Again, all too easy to turn our life, our Dharma practice, Buddhism, into a way of making ourselves comfortable in samsara. That's not what we're about. So service can be a real corrective to that. Offering up your life, you know, to the Dharma. Offering up your meditation to the Dharma, to something greater. So Richard Aketu is living a fully committed Dharma life. He's no doubt practicing ethics, meditation, devotional practice. He studies, he teaches, he works for the Dharma in Rajagriha. He benefits the people in his city and in the wider community. So it's a very brief description of a life of real depth and intensity. And when you live such a life of Dharma service, Dharma practice, things happen. Of course they do. There are fruits that come from such a life. But they're not always easy things. In fact, some of the things that come might not even seem like fruits. They might seem more like, you know, some horrible kind of fungus that's growing in your garden that you need to get rid of. They might not seem like fruits at all. Such a life creates difficulties, challenges, even problems. And Rūchira Ketu hits a problem, a very serious problem. And his problem is this: what is the cause? What is the reason why the Lord Shakyamuni had such a short measure of life as 80 years? 80 only. Now that will seem to us a very strange kind of problem to have. I doubt if it's very much of a problem for any of us, any of you. I don't know if you woke up this morning wondering on the shortness, the brevity of the Buddha's life. But for Rūchira Ketu, it was a serious problem. It's a problem for Rūchira Ketu because the Buddha had said that there are two reasons, two conditions that lead to a long life. First of all, refraining from killing living beings, the first precept. And secondly, giving away food. Traditionally, if you do those two things, you will have a long life. And Rūchira Ketu had a further reflection. The Buddha, in his life of a bodhisattva, refrained from killing living beings and gave away food for incalculable eons. He even gave his body as food on many occasions to living beings. So not only did he not kill living beings, he was prepared to give his body as food for living beings. So surely, given that he did this over an incalculably long period of time, surely he could have lived longer than 80 years. That's Rūchira Ketu's problem. He could have lived for an infinite number of eons, presumably. And I think that this problem looking into it, thinking about it a little bit more deeply, his problem reflects a very deep concern among Indian Buddhists in the centuries following the Buddha's parinirvana. This is why it's a problem. It's reflecting a very deep concern. You need to realise that the Buddha's parinirvana was catastrophic for the vast majority of Indian Buddhists. It was catastrophic. This was the loss of the teacher. This was the loss of the teacher of gods and men. This is the loss of the very embodiment of Buddhahood, of enlightenment. This is the loss of the shower of the way to enlightenment. Yes, there may well be other great teachers around, but he has gone. The teacher has gone. Of course, for the enlightened disciples, it wasn't catastrophic because they were enlightened. They didn't feel any loss of connection with enlightenment. They didn't associate enlightenment with that particular form. Enlightenment was a living presence for them all the time. And of course, when we read the Parinibbana Sutta, very often we tend to identify with the enlightened disciples. I don't know if you noticed that. When you read the suttas, we never identify with the stupid people who are in difficulties. We always identify with the sensible, enlightened ones. We should be identifying with those who are feeling great sorrow at the loss, the parting, the departing of the Buddha. That's where we're at. We need to realise that enlightenment has gone out of the world. That's the feeling among Indian Buddhists. Enlightenment has gone. It's catastrophic. And I know people will say, hang on, what about attachment? And what about all that? Well, you know, unless you can really feel a connection with the Buddha, you can't really talk about not being attached to the Buddha. That really doesn't come into things until you can really feel the deep and profound connection with the Buddha. So it was a deep loss for Indian Buddhists, a deep sense of absence. But so why did he go? The greatly wise and compassionate one, why did he go? He could have lived, surely, for endless ages, as we have it in our own puja book. Why? Why is the light of the world not present when he surely could have been? This is Ruchiriketu's very serious problem. I'm going to come back to that a bit later, that the solution to Ruchiriketu's problem and the absence of the Buddha. But I want to, before going any further, I want to look at Bhante's discussion of problems more generally. He looks a little at problems. So this is what he says about problems in Dharma life. One could go as far as to say that there is no spiritual life without problems. Problems are a means of development, even a means of transformation. By problems, I don't mean difficulties, little passing difficulties that look so big and important at the moment. Difficulties can be met simply by using our intelligence and by making an even greater effort. But a problem cannot be solved on its own terms. A real problem cannot be solved, and yet it must be solved. And he goes on to say this is the meaning of the Zen koan, you know, which the Zen practitioners in some traditions sweat over year after year after year. What is the sound of one hand clapping? You've got to solve that. What does it mean to take a step off a 100-foot pole? You're up a pole, you've got to step off it. But as Sangharakshita says, these Zen koans probably won't be real koans for us. They're not real problems for us. What we need is what the Zen tradition calls life koans. We need to find the life koans in our experience. Koans, problems, are generated by our life by our spiritual practice. And you can see this in Sangharakshita's own life. I don't know if you remember in the early part of his memoirs, the conflict between what he called Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2. The Sangharakshita that loved to write poetry, that wanted to lie in bed and dream, that wanted to just meet people and travel and discover new experience. The poet, artist, dreamer, if you like, and the Sangharakshita who was the monk, the ascetic, who wanted to fast, meditate, pray, turn away from the world, and how much they were in conflict with one another, even fighting one another. That's a real problem. That's a real problem. You know, to have those two sides of yourself, both demanding to be lived from fully and completely. As Bhante says, a real koan springs up quite naturally from your own life, from your own thought, from your own experience. It's something you can't get rid of, something you are stuck with, something inseparable from your own life, your own self, your own personality. It's something that is you, impossible, contradictory you, problematic you. That is the real koan. How do you solve the problem? The insoluble problem. How do you resolve the absurdity of it all? The discomfort, the distress. Wow. We are the problem. What are we to do with this life? This Dharma life, this committed life, which we're living with others. You know, it will really generate problems, this kind of life, for us. I was this last week before this retreat, I was doing a bit more meditation and also prostration practice, and feeling, in a sense, a sort of problem, certainly a sort of tension within my being, between, if you like, the demand to be alone and have space and be with myself, which has its own challenges, and the demands of responding to others and being with others in a way that is genuinely, you know, effective, genuinely dharmic, that isn't just the expression of my own extroversion. And I was really feeling it, really feeling that tension, not really quite knowing what to do with retreats, this retreat especially, looming up, what to do, how to be, and finding it really quite difficult, even talking, bending Aryapada's ear a bit with this particular sort of challenge, problem, really, really feeling it. Maybe it was a difficulty, but it felt like a problem, feels like a problem. And I won't say it's resolved, but I did have a very vivid dream image which kind of clarified the situation, which kind of made me felt you know, more buoyant. And in this dream image, I was on a long circular walk, such as I would do around here. But this particular circular walk had taken me into a region of Africa. I'm reading books about Africa at the moment. So I was in this African marshland with these sort of duck boards, you know, placed across it. So I was on this circular walk somehow in Africa, in this jungle marsh. And I got on the, I thought, oh, okay, good, I'll go across these boards. And they were spaced across this marsh, got onto the first one, then onto the second one, and realised that it was a bit of a leap to the next one, and realised I was on a very narrow, rickety board above this marsh. And actually, turning back, I realised I didn't know how I'd got onto this middle board. And I knew that if I fell off, basically, I was going to be sucked down into this marsh. I couldn't go forward, I couldn't go back, and I was clinging to this rickety, narrow board. What happened next? I started to fall asleep and woke up into another dream. So I didn't actually resolve it, but it did. The image, I thought, this is me. this is you, Padmavajra, right now. So live with it. So it can be like that sometimes. Our life, our Dharma life, we're holding on onto a rickety plank above a marsh. We can't go forward, we can't go back, neither can we sink into this marsh. Woo. That's my koan. Perhaps I should meditate on that every day now. But what happens to Ruchira Ketu while contemplating his problem? Now, while this good man was thinking this and similar thoughts of mindfulness and concentration on the Buddha, and that's significant as well, his problem, his koan, comes from his meditation, his samadhi upon the Buddha. It's not just any kind of stray thought. It's a deep engagement, you could say, with the Buddha. While doing this, his house became vast and extensive, made of beryl, adorned with numerous divine jewels, a transformation due to the Tathagata, filled with perfumes surpassing the gods. And in that house, in the four directions, there appeared four seats made of divine jewels, and on those seats, mats made of divine jewels, and fine cotton cloth spread out, and on those mats, divine lotuses adorned with numerous jewels, transformations due to the Tathagata. And on those lotuses there appeared four Lord Buddhas. In the east appeared the Tathagata Akshobhya. In the south appeared the Tathagata Ratnaketu. In the west appeared the Tathagata Amitayus. In the north appeared the Tathagata Dundubhisvara. And those Lord Buddhas appeared immediately upon lion thrones. As well as this, the great city of Rajagriha was filled with a great light, as well as the triple thousand great thousand world sphere. Divine flowers rained down, divine musical instruments sounded, and through the Buddha's power, his Anubhava, the blind could see, the deaf could hear, those conscious became mindful, they woke up, those distraught became at ease, the naked became clothed, the hungry full-bellied, the thirsty drank, those with diseases became free of disease. On a large scale in the world, there was an appearance of miraculous things. And of course, Ruchira Ketu, seeing this, especially seeing the four Buddhas, became amazed, and he wonders, how is this possible? How is this possible? He's just filled with wonder. He's not thinking, oh, I'm the big guy who's had the vision. He's just amazed. He's been in the grip of a problem. He's been intensely engaged in the problem of the Buddha. And this just opens up. So he's delighted. He's amazed. He rejoices. He's full of joy and gladness. He worships the Buddhas immediately. And he recollects Shakyamuni. Recollects, if you like, the Buddha, his teacher. So this really is visionary literature, visionary Buddhism, you could say. And there really is no other. This is the imaginal realm indeed. This is the picture, the vision, the image of higher consciousness. And it's best to really just to savour it, to enjoy it. Let it communicate its own indefinable meaning. Bhante does, however, give us some pointers to help us appreciate the full significance of what's going on. Through Ruchira Ketu's intense engagement with his problem, with the Buddha, his meditation on the Buddha, his house expands, becomes vast, becomes coextensive with space. So Bhante says, the house is everything that belongs to us. The house represents our personal framework, our habitual state of consciousness. It means that we cannot solve our problem on its own level. We cannot solve the problem of ourselves on our own level. There needs to be an expansion, not just a horizontal expansion, a vertical expansion, an opening up beyond, completely beyond the psychological, you could say, beyond the ordinary, beyond all worldly ambitions, all craving and aversion and so on, all self-definition. We're moving into an entirely different dimension, a dimension made of jewels, and especially mentioned throughout the sutra, actually, is this jewel beryl, B-E-R-Y-L, which comes apparently in many colours, but noticeably it comes as emerald. So we have to imagine a vast house, a vast structure made of emerald, shining and translucent, made up of jewelled light. For some traditions, mystical traditions, emerald is the colour of the imaginal realm itself. You get it in Hermeticism, don't you? The Smaragdine tablet, the emerald tablet, which shows that what is below, as above, so below. As above, so below. A world, in other words, the world when you attain, when you find this emerald tablet, the forms which best communicate, which are transparent to reality itself. This is what's going on, I think, here in Ruchiraketu's vision. These forms, these imaginal forms, are transparent to the nature of reality. Reality is showing through. So often when we think or talk about higher states of consciousness, about dhyana and beyond, we stay in our highly conceptual, highly analytical, literal-mindedness. But it would be much better, I think, when we meditate and when we think about meditation, when we discuss meditation, it would be better if we could imagine. It would be much better if we could employ poetry and image and symbolism, because higher states of consciousness are beautiful, made of jewels and made of light. And it's in this realm that the Tathagatas appear, that the Buddhas appear. Here, they're a kind of early version of four of the five Buddhas, the five Jinnas, the five Tathagatas. It's interesting, the original Tantric tradition is a four Buddha system, not a five Buddha system. They're sitting on wonderful thrones in this vast emerald house. And it's also clear from the text that for Ruchiraketu, these Buddhas are no different from Shakyamuni. They emerge out of his deep meditation upon the Buddha, upon Shakyamuni. And it's important, I think, to recall this, you know, all these forms in this room, all these images, all these paintings. They're all, if you like, expressions of the Buddha's enlightenment. They're all enabling us to appreciate the profundity, the inconceivability of the Buddha's enlightenment, of Shakyamuni's enlightenment. They're no different from the Buddha's enlightenment. Very important to remember that. It's something that Sangharakshita has been very, very keen on, especially in recent years, that how important it is to see all this wonderful rainbow world of different Buddha forms as images. We relate them back to the qualities of the Buddha himself. In fact, he said he did want he wanted there to be a painting of the Buddha with the different forms emerging from him and going back to him. I mentioned this to Aloka because he said he thought Aloka would make a very good job of it, and Aloka said, "I really don't want to do that. Please don't. I hope he doesn't ask me, because that sounds like a really difficult painting to pull off." Anyway, as well as this, as well as the four Buddhas in this emerald, vast emerald house, if you can call it a house anymore, light, great light, fills Rajagriha, fills the entire cosmos. And this light is the blessing power of the Buddha, his Anubhava, His Anubhava is a term that comes from kingship. It's this the great wielding of power, the power to bless, to give life. And this light is healing all beings. So as well as a transformation of self, there is a vision of the transformation of world. Maybe there has been, for a moment, a transformation of the world. Self, if you like, expands and vanishes into an all-transforming light, which is love, which is compassion, which is a transforming blessing power. I think very important when we talk about encounters with reality, with the way things are, this must never be separated out from its impact on our environment, its beneficent impact on our environment. Any breakthrough must, in the end, involve love and compassion and loving and compassionate activity. And within all this, amidst his joy, Rudhiriketu's problem surfaces. In this greatly expanded consciousness, the problem arises again, no doubt in a different key, in a different mode, if you like. Why is it that the Lord Shakyamuni had such a brief measure of life as 80 years? This is being intoned in the depths of Samadhi. And the four Buddhas knew directly Rudhiriketu's reflection. And they immediately told Rudhiriketu, and presumably it's all a mind-to-mind transmission, they tell him that he should not think in this way. He's got it wrong. They tell him that they do not see anybody in the entire cosmos who know the furthest end, the furthest limit of the Tathagata's life. And at this, numerous beings, the Nagas and the Yakshas and the Rakshasas, you know, all these extraordinary beings and gods and all the rest of it, they come to the vast house. They fill it up as the Tathagatas spoke. And a particular group of gods are particularly concerned with this, and the Tathagatas then give a great intoning of verses on the length of life of the Tathagata, and various other things happen after that. But the basic message of all this is that the Buddha is beyond life and death. The Buddha has attained the deathless. And this culminates in the gods of the 33 who've raised the bodhicitta. They sing this: the Buddha does not enter parinirvana, and the Dharma does not disappear. For the ripening of beings does the Buddha teach complete nirvana. The Lord Buddha is inconceivable. The Tathagata has an eternal body. He shows various manifestations by reason of the welfare of beings. Rudhiriketu is joyful. He's delighted. He's filled with noble bliss. Innumerable beings develop the bodhicitta, and the Tathagatas disappear. So what are the implications to all this? Well, perhaps the implication, and I'm only guessing, is that the Buddha is always available. It's always possible to contact the Buddha, to meet with the Buddha. It's always possible to hear the Dharma from the Buddha if you're living an intense enough, committed enough Dharma life, a life of serving the Buddha, of recollecting the Buddha, of going for refuge to the Buddha. One tradition says, when it's describing what recollection of the Buddha, remembering the Buddha, bringing the Buddha to mind, what is the main practice of that? They say it is going for refuge to the Buddha. If you go for refuge to the Buddha, you will be recollecting the Buddha. You will be in contact with the Buddha. You will be learning from the Buddha. You will be able to see the Buddha if you go for refuge to him. If you say Buddhang Saranam Gacchami with real depth, with real sincerity, with real purity, and you live that Buddhang Saranam Gacchami with body, speech and mind in everything that you do, then indeed you will see the Buddha. He will be available to you. I'm going to end with actually the very last part of the Sutra of Golden Light, and it's staying with this theme of longing to see the Buddha, and in a sense how that is resolved, if you like. It's a song, a hymn, if you like, sung by a goddess named Bodhisattva Samuchaya. I'm just going to read part of it. Constantly, constantly, I lovingly remember the Buddha. And constantly, I'm yearning to see him. Constantly, eternally, I make a vow to see the fully enlightened Buddha son. Constantly kneeling on the ground, I burn with sorrow to see the Buddha. In a pitiful voice, I sob for him. I am deeply thirsty to see he who has gone to bliss, always burning with the fire of longing. Give me the cool water of seeing your beautiful form. O leader, turn to me with the feeling of compassion. Grant me the vision of your serene and beautiful form. Gladden me with the water of compassion, for you are the refuge of the world with its gods. And the bodies of the disciples are empty. All beings are by nature like a dream, like space, like the sky by nature, like a magical illusion, a mirage, or the moon reflected in water. O leader, you who are endowed with the great empty. And the sphere of the Tathagata is pure like crystal. The Tathagata has entered the city of the supreme nectar of the deathless Dharma. He is able to bring unlimited blessings. The sphere of the Tathagata is subtle, wonderful, and very profound. No one is able to fathom the sphere of the Tathagata. Among the sages endowed with the super knowledges, among all the disciples and solitary sages, none of them are able to fathom it. But I have no doubt concerning the sphere of the Buddha. May he therefore, out of love and compassion, show himself to me.